Well, we ought to be able to get at least two out of this. That would, we already have four, don't we? I have the book here, so afterward, we could look and see. So at least two more ought to be doable, and that would give us drop two out of six to go with it. And again, the less quizzes, the better for that matter, isn't it? Yeah. So this particular time period will cover World War I from 1914 to 1919. And then the 1920s in a domestic look. We're going to look at foreign policy of the 1920s in the next, if there is a next testing section, which we will. And then in the 1930s, the New Deal, Depression era under FDR. So it's 1914 to 1939, but after we get to the 20s, it's just domestic until we get past the 1939 period. That's how I cover World War II, is do all the domestic first, then come back and do 20s, 30s foreign policy as it leads up to World War II. It makes more sense that way. So I was thinking about what would be a good introduction and start to this, and there's so many ways to explain why World War I is of such significance. Even though I guess, in fairness, World War II does have a greater impact on changing the world than World War I, I've always thought in terms of teaching, World War I seems to be more. It seems to give you the opportunity to at least discuss more, because it can be fairly said, not too hard to argue, that the outcome of World War I, and especially the Treaty of World War I, sets the stage, plants the seeds for the Second World War to take place, plants the seeds for the Vietnam conflict to take place, does the same for the Arab-Israeli situation that we're still facing today in the Middle East, that all of these things are results of war policy or the treaty ending the war. And what I was fooling around with the map over here going to show was this is the Europe as of 1914, and here's how it looks. Here's how it looked, not with all the arrows, in 1919. So what a change will happen in regards to the creation of new countries in just 5 years from this point here. And that's true not only for Europe, but it's true for the world in regards to imperial changes and the independence of nations, etc. Another feature that you can kind of think about when you're talking about World War I is prior to the war, we did not see widespread use of such things as submarines and poison gas and aerial bombing and zeppelins and massive use of machine guns and heavy artillery. I mean, these things all come about as the quick technological leap forward, if that is forward, in World War I. And sadly, the ability to kill far outraced the ability to heal in the post-World War I period. So it quickly shoves the world technologically forward. The death and destruction of World War I, which was close to 15 million, was so shocking that no one thought people would be stupid enough to launch another war of that nature. And of course, then we have a 35 to 50 million deaths in World War II. So people then, after World War II, thought nobody would be crazy enough to start a third World War, and they haven't yet. And maybe we won't. So that's... In fact, really, in recent years, it's been, instead of major nation states conducting wars, it's been freelance private organizations being involved in pestering major nation states. So who knows how that'll turn around. But World War I was in many ways a doorway or a gateway which took the old 19th century world into the present day with technological and the attitudes about nationalism, etc., which leads to the second statement here. There are four long-range causes of World War I. Now, if you ask what caused World War I, someone might say, well, somebody shot an archduke from Austria, and that's true, but that's the spark that ignites the keg. Here is the keg of powder waiting to explode. Four major long-range causes that lead to World War I. The first one is a system of creating alliances and secret treaties. So the enactment of secret treaties and alliances is our first long-range cause. Second is an upsurge in militarism, or I should say military hardware buildup, like we were just talking about. Third was the scramble for strategic locations or imperial rivalries, be they commercial or militarily. And the fourth one, which can be divided into two different examples, which we'll look at, is 20th century nationalism and how it's a factor. Now, in some ways, you could say that all four of these, the alliances and secret treaties, the military buildup, the imperialism and rivalries, and nationalism were pursued in order to keep the peace rather than start a war. Alliances were built in order to create enough of an armed camp that others would be afraid to attack. Secret treaties supposedly were so Byzantine and convoluted nobody knew who would attack whom where, so it wasn't worth the risk of trying to steal somebody's territory. Militarism is one of the most well-defended arguments for peace. If you're armed to the teeth, someone won't attack. If you're weak, you leave yourself vulnerable. The imperial rivalries, that's probably the least peace preservative, but again, it comes from the perspective that if you have good choice locations to fortify your nation with resources and protect your interests, someone will not attack. And then nationalism was the belief that if, at least the second type of nationalism, that if every ethnic minority had self-determination and could rule themselves, there would be no need for revolutions and upsurge. So these causes of these isms that were growing at the turn of the century were really pursued on the idea of security, how to keep your nation secure from being attacked. The last war Europe saw prior to World War I, major conflict, was the Franco-Prussian War. This isn't on your test, but it's helpful to understand. It's the Franco-Prussian War of 1871. That was a war that was primarily France versus Germany, and the outcome of it was disunited German provinces for the first time in 1871 after winning the conflict became a united nation. So we see the first united Germany under the leadership of Otto von Bismarck and Wilhelm I in 1871. The defeat of France, and with the defeat of France, if this map is large enough to show it, two provinces here, Alsace and Lorraine transferred to German control here. So we'll come back and talk again about those provinces. We have to write about that. But Alsace and Lorraine, two provinces that sat between Germany and France, lost by France to Germany as a result of the Franco-Prussian War. The problem here, and this is indicative of the problem of Europe that we'll look at, is Alsace and Lorraine had about equal mixed German-speaking and French-speaking people, both wishing to be with either Germany or France accordingly. And this idea of like-spoken or like-cultured people wanting to be with some greater nation-state is the real factor that's the problem that causes the wars here. So when the Franco-Prussian War ended, both Germany and France immediately set out to prepare themselves for war with each other again. Each is going to be the cause of a future war, and so they start building alliances for protection. And that's what number one shows. These are the two armed camps that France and Germany built, I guess on the one hand you could say to prevent war, or on the other hand, after war starts off, win the war. The first one, the Triple Alliance, much more a defense alliance than the second one. The second one is more like a series of tripodded agreements which bring all three together but never as a unified front. But the first one truly was a firm defense alliance. It included Germany. The Austro-Hungarian Empire in 1867, the monarchies of Austria and Hungary married and combined their empires. You can see what significant that is. Look how small Austria and Hungary is here after the war. Here's the size. Prior to the war, so you see what an enormous landholding Austria had at this time by combining the two empires. You have Germany and Austria-Hungary and Italy, which is the center of Europe, armed together. That would isolate France from any potential allies other than England and Russia, which came to be. In fact, one could say that England, Russia, and France saw the threat of the Triple Alliance, started to negotiate separate individual agreements with each other, and eventually through that tripodded situation created a second major alliance called the Triple Entente, which by 1907 was now seen as the other alliance. When we get the war started and nations line up a little bit differently, that'll be number seven, but for the most part, your Triple Alliance and number one will end up being the central powers of number seven. And the Triple Entente of number one will end up being the allies of number 7. It's not exactly a complete crossover of the same nations, but it's close enough. And these, as I said, these nations had met secretly and made agreements. Most of the agreements they made were, if attacked here, will you come to my defense or not? If we move in on this particular Afghanistan or Morocco or islands of China, which is close to your area, will you feel threatened or not? And so these agreements were all set up to try to prevent conflict from breaking out. But the other side of this was nobody knew who was really obligated to attack whom. And so the secrecy itself led to unexpected consequences of everybody jumping in a week's time later. When you look at the Versailles Treaty, and especially the 14 points that Woodrow Wilson will put together for the treaty, most of the 14 points that Woodrow Wilson will advocate in 1918 are trying to address the problems of these four things here. So you look at these four causes. Wilson believes that he can create a treaty which will eliminate these causes from ever starting war again. We'll look at that later. So we already talked about militarism, and that is the belief that the more armed to the teeth you were, the safer you are. And that becomes a great debate both before and after World War II. Is peace maintained through extensive unlimited armaments, making the other side not dare or risk attacking? Or is peace maintained by mutual disarmament and collective security, which calls for a lot of trust, and lots of times it's not easy to trust. And one of those things that we'll look at is we'll put some negotiations together in the 1920s and 30s in hopes that we'll stay out of war, and of course it instead World War II happens anyway, and some of it actually enabled the Japanese to be a greater threat because of our build down and their build up. So the attitudes following World War II is it was stupid to negotiate with potential enemies, and we didn't enter into an arms reductions agreement from 1945 until when? Or have we ever? Have we ever negotiated and reduced our arms like we did in the 1920s? 1987, Reagan and Gorbachev, which is so surprising because Reagan was the one that called the Soviets the evil empire, and he's the one that called for the great buildup, and yet finally he is also the one that for the first time not just agrees to limit but to reduce arms in 1987. But that's from 45 to 87, that's how long it took for us to get over thinking it was a mistake to limit or reduce arms because of the experiences of World War I and World War II. So that's why World War I has such significance into the future of lessons that should have been learned, lessons that should have not been learned. And you can find those same parallels today with our war on terror, wrongly and rightly. And as I've already mentioned, the greed and the hunger of major nations to have imperial spheres of influence in parts of the Middle East or in parts of China, etc. We've already talked about the Boxer Uprising being a response to European imperialism. There are those who say a simple explanation for World War I is Austria, Germany, and Italy had next to no overseas colonies, and Germany, France, and Russia did. And therefore, the have-nots wanted to steal colonies from the haves. And that's probably simplistic but accurate. But the part I find the most fascinating, and I think the most instrumental to the outbreak of the war, is the fourth cause, nationalism. And we need to look at nationalism from two perspectives. One from the jingoistic perspective, and the second one from self-determination for estranged minorities. Now, here's where college is different than high school. I'm going to ask a question and you're going to know the answer. What is jingoism? We did this, right? Yes, and therefore we have nationalism and we have the right to intervene, take over, defend our interests, defend our honor. Like, say, for example, some of our sailors got off course and captured by a country. If something like that happened, like Iran did to Britain, then you don't do that to the British by jingo. We could move in and attack. That's jingoism. So that's kind of stuff that in high school, some will answer, but most will say, did we ever do that? So that's what makes more fun to be here. And they did this time around, so I'm not just picking on them without experience that happened this week. So, but the and jingoism usually implies a major nation state that is powerful and wants to exert its major nation state status to pick on or to dominate or to exert hegemony over some area. But there is a second type of nationalism also. And the first one, no doubt, is a cause for war. But the second one is people who do not have a nation. People who are forced to live under the rule of someone else. Maybe an example might be, well, let's use some current day examples. Why do French Quebecers get wired up? And let's be nice and not just say because they're French. That's mean. Why do French-speaking Quebec people are often have an axe to grind? Why is that? Maybe I'm being unfair and prejudiced here. Are they happy being in with a bunch of British, English-speaking Canadians? No, they're not. They complain, and rightly so, that they produce the majority of the resources and wealth of the country, but don't have near the voice of leadership and representation that they should. Underneath that argument, underneath the money argument, what's their real complaint? Nationalism. They want to be a separate nation. They want to be a French Canada separate from an English-speaking Canada. And that runs all the way back to being conquered by England in 1763. There's always been that strain of feeling. And they have plebiscites over it. And the last plebiscite was like 49.8% to quit. So they're just 2% away from getting, or 2.8% away from getting an independent nation. Another question to approach would be, are there Palestinian Arabs? Tricky question here. I'm trying to get a big debate going on. And I'm not. Your answer doesn't mean you're pro or anti-Israel. This is just a history discussion here. Are there those people who see themselves as Palestinian Arabs? That's a safer question. Is there a Palestine?
No.
Okay. There was. It is now. Israel, yes. And after this 1967 Six-Day War, Israel grew in size and took in more neighboring Arabs to the point now where the nation is half Arab and half Jewish, or half Israeli, I should say. And what's the circumstance that these, what's the wishes ultimately of the Arabs living there? To have their own separate state, to have a separate Palestinian state. And I could come up with probably four or five more examples like the Tamils and Indonesia or something, but what am I trying to connect together here? Maybe Basques living in Andorra between France and Spain. Or Catalonians near Barcelona. People of a cultural affinity, might be religion, might be ethnicity, might be both, but they're not ruling themselves. They're in some larger state who has voice over them. That's what we mean by this self-determination, meaning the right to rule oneself for estranged minorities. And to bring it back to our World War I story, you look at this map, and the lines on it are kind of confusing. Looking at this map here, up in this area here, the way to start this would be this. Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, separate Austria-Hungary, Czechoslovakia, a greater Yugoslavia. Where are those countries I just named on this five-year earlier map? Yeah, they're part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, they're part of Russia. Maybe part of the Turkish Empire, if we were talking about the same thing in regards to the Arab states. So, where am I going with this?
Austria and Hungary had more than one different ethnic group, and each ethnic group had their
own country. Right. In fact, let's build on that. Where was the demand for ethnic solidarity and self-determination the strongest and probably the most explosive at this time? There is a B word that describes it.
Bohemians?
Close. Bohemians are in that situation too, part of the Czech breakaway. Well, what is this peninsula down here called?
Moldova. Baltic.
The Balkans. And you've ever heard the expression, the Balkanization of a culture, the Balkanization of a country? If you have, it means when what was a united nation splinters off into so many separate religions and races, etc., and there's no national unity left. Conservatives in America are very concerned that multiculturalism that liberals promote is going to be the Balkanization of America. We're going to lose a common national identity by too much emphasis upon separate ethnicities and religions. And that is what happened here. In fact, this little thing is the ponder. Serbia and this area of Bosnia, as well as Croatia, Montenegro, and other couple of places, became for a while one giant Yugoslavian nation. And after World War II, Yugoslavia was kept together from 1945 till 1991 under who? Who was the Yugoslavian strongman who was a communist but was not a very cooperative communist with the Russian Uncle was? Close. Tito. Marshal Tito. Joseph Broz Tito. And Tito kept all those various ethnic and religious groups, Muslim, Christian, Croatian, all these different groups, under one control. And then what happens? He dies. And then what happens? Civil war broke out. You may recall that in Bosnia and Sarajevo, there were all those snipers and all that trouble. After there had been such a successful Winter Olympics, the country of Yugoslavia broke into pieces, splintered. Milosevic led Serbians to attack Kosovarians. And we had to intervene on that. All of that because one strong man who had control over things, and a cruel dictator, by the way, left the scene. Then all hell broke loose. Then there was Saddam Hussein, who I'm not praising, but kept control over Iraq, and then he was removed, and all hell breaks loose. So sometimes the way these groups stay together is not because they're in harmony, because there's a thumbs on them. And the same was true, probably, about the Soviet Union. That when it started to splinter apart and go, it could have been pretty nasty too. But Gorbachev just said, go. I'm not going to have a civil war here as well. I'll lose my job if it means you people don't kill each other. So Gorbachev was like that. So it is this area that is the most explosive. And powder keg of Europe, as it's called. Here's where things get very specific. Look at this southern portion of Austria called Bosnia, where Sarajevo is at. Bosnia's greatest ethnic minority was Slavic, like Serbia. When we talk about Slavic, we talked about that at all yet? I think we did. We talked about Slavic immigrants to America. They are Eastern European people who are made up of, well, the nations of Poland, Russia, Bulgaria, Serbia. Those are, for the most part, Slavic people. It's a variety of Caucasians in Eastern Europe. In the 1870s onward, Russia started to promote what it called a pan-Slavic movement, an identity movement. If you are a Slavic background, you have things in common. By the way, the word Slavic is the source of the word slave, because when Western Europeans would attack and conquer Eastern Europeans, they would enslave them. That name came from that. So they were always looked down upon as ethnically inferior to Western Europeans. Being looked down upon by Western Europeans as inferior, this is why Russia wanted to launch this. Slavs must stand together and make themselves a powerful front to be reckoned with by the West. And so Serbian Slavs and Bosnian Slavs had this common interest to be a nation of its own, hopefully breaking Bosnia away from Austria. What one particular revolutionary group, the Black Hand, had in mind, and we are into number four now, this Serbian nationalist group hiding in Bosnia had the idea, what would happen if we killed a high official of Austria, causing a war between Serbia and Austria, causing all the nations of Europe to jump into the war, and eventually resulting in a united Yugoslavia? And that's exactly what happened. So you often hear the expression that terrorism never wins. Maybe in the long, long run it doesn't, but it did do exactly this. It did trigger a war and create a Yugoslavia. The person they target is Archduke Franz Ferdinand. He is the heir to the throne. His father, Franz Joseph, is close to dying. Ferdinand is being groomed to become the next emperor of the Austrian Empire. He is well aware of these ethnic tensions in parts of the empire, the Czech region, Bohemian region, Bosnian area. And so in June of 1914, June 28th in fact, Franz Ferdinand makes a very overt visit to Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia, to assert his authority and presence. The Black Hand is ready and waiting to attack. In fact, they have to attack five times that day. Throwing a bomb, shooting again. Finally, on the fifth attempt, when this carriage, and he'd heard of these things, he heard the gunshots and the bomb explosions, continued to parade around saying, "I will not be intimidated." And finally, at one street corner, he stops, stares out, and they've got a good sight on him, and they shot him and killed him. So that was on June 28th, 1914. They are Bosnian Serbs who want to see a united Bosnia and Serbia. They're Slavic. I want to say freedom fighters, but I just can't push myself to do it, so I'll say terrorists. A united Bosnia and Serbia into a Yugoslavia. Austria is certain that the assassins are connected to Serbia, and so the Austrian government demands of Serbia to allow Austrian police to move into Serbia to look for the assassins. And the Serbian government refuses. And Austria gives them 1 month ultimatum that in 1 month's time, if you don't let us in, it's war. The month ticks by, and July 28, 1914, Austria declares war and invades Serbia. And that's the start of World War I. And it ignites a chain of war declarations and entries due to the alliances, as five shows. So six kind of sums up step by step some events here. You're not going to be tested per se on anything in six, but let's follow through it together and see what happens. July 28th, Austria attacks Serbia. On July 29th, Russia declares war on Austria. Now let's try to figure out why that happens. Russia, the next day, declares war on Austria for attacking Serbia. There's a couple of reasons for this. We've already explained one. What's the first one? Ethnic solidarity. There's fellow Slavic people coming to the aid of fellow Slavic people invading. But it's not as simple as that. In our foreign policy, there's defense human rights with national interests going on. Russia is an area that most of the year does not have a warm water port. The ports here and off in Siberia are usually frozen over. What they wanted for a long, long time is an access to a warm water port year-round, which the Black Sea, where these two Dardanelles and Bosporus area would work for. So Russians would love to take advantage of a war with Austria as being able to move in and annex territory here once the war started. That will help explain in item 7 why the Turks join the Central Powers. Turkey, which is a country that spreads both in Europe and Asia because it controls areas right across here, Turkey, or the Ottoman Turkish Empire, will enter the war on the side of the Germans and the Austrians as a way of trying to prevent Russia from taking that area. And also, the Turks feared that the Austrians were going to move to take their core also, so their own allies can take it, they want to secure their interests.
Once Russia gets in the conflict, you have one of each of the two alliances involved. So now the questions arise, are the other alliance partners committed and obligated, and are they going to honor their commitments and obligations? Well, France and Germany don't even exchange any kind of official activity. They just march their troops towards each other and assume war is on. So France and Germany are at war with each other by August 1st. So by August 3rd, we have in place warring activity between Germany and Austria versus France and Russia. Britain wants to hold out of this first and see what happens, but when Germany invades Belgium on August 4th, that's when Britain declares war on Germany, because Belgium was a neutral nation on the coast, a very close, dangerous launching of a possible invasion site, and in 1839, England had negotiated with Belgium to protect their neutrality in case of any threat. So Germany's invasion of Belgium to attack France triggers England's declaration of war.
Germany's invasion of Belgium to attack France, what?
triggers the English declaration of war on Germany. So now we have Germany, Austria in the war, Britain, France, and Russia in the war. The only nation of the first two alliances we talked about that hasn't committed yet is Italy. And here's the most disgusting part of the beginning of this war. Italy holds off going into war and engages in serious secret negotiations with both sides for a year. World War II, they were pretty solid pro-Hitler from the start, with the Mussolini's fascism. And in these negotiations, they're arguing for which side will give us more port cities from the Austrian coast when the war is over. And finally, Britain and France and Russia make better promises than do the Germans, and so they join the Allied side. So we're going to add a couple of countries into number seven, but before we do, what do you think that does to the American psyche? They're watching war take place in a matter of minutes or days or whatever. It seems like all these countries, major countries, are at war. One of them going after it's discovered is promised more greedy imperialism. That's Europeans. That's why we came here. That's why we don't want anything. That's why Washington was right and the Monroe Doctrine was right, to stay out of their affairs. It's nothing but trouble for us. Two other nations need to be known here in the lineup. Now we're on number seven. Central powers would include Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Turkey. Allies would include, as we said already, France, Russia, and Britain. In later August of 1914, just a month after this starts, Japan declares war on Germany. Now, why is Japan way over in the Far East declaring war on European Germany? Here's why. Germany had Chinese islands under its control, spheres of influence. The Germans are tied up in Europe. They can't protect their Chinese islands, so Japan is going to steal Chinese islands from Germany. Which is why China joined the same side. China joins the same side in hopes that when the war is over, the British, the French, and the Russians will discipline the Japanese to give back the islands. It's an unbelievable early 20th century mess occurring here. Japan wants to steal German possessions, Chinese islands, from Germany while they're tied up in war. China believes the only way to defend themselves from Japan is to get in on the same side, because they think that Japan's allies can discipline them to give back. We're all on the same side, we don't steal each other's territories type thinking.
So China declares war on Germany
also? Yes. All the main part that China plays in this is to send labor groups to come do some of the labor in Europe that frees up soldiers from France and England to be fighting. So there's not combat troops in China coming.
So Japan wants to regain the islands back from Germany.
Not regain, gain.
They want to
steal them, yes.
So China's thinking that if they allow Japan to win, then Japan will...
If you're in on the same side as everybody else, aren't you supposed to kind of work together and respect each other, not steal each other's lands, especially if you can get the biggies, England and France, to help you get the discipline going there? It didn't work out that well. Japan still stole Chinese islands in the peace treaty. And the really surprising part to this is it didn't have to happen. Japan came to Woodrow Wilson during the peace treaty and said, if you will put into the peace treaty a plank recognizing racial equality, we'll give up our Chinese demands. And the Wilson response was, while I believe in that, which he didn't, he was a racist. He said, well, I believe in that, Southern and Western senators would never ratify it, so you'll just have to keep the Chinese island. Racism is more important in Wilson's thinking. I know you're wanting to run away, but I want to just bring us up to something here. Up to number eight. Throughout 1914 and 1915, America is appalled by what's gone on, and our President Wilson declares we will remain neutral in both name and spirit. And to try to make sure of it, for the first year of the war, Wilson puts a ban on trading with Europeans. He doesn't want to see us dragged into a war by being attacked, so it's illegal to sell and trade materials from 1914 to 1915. It causes an economic recession in New England, which creates an outcry, and by 1915 he drops the ban and we're in business again selling. And even though the majority of Americans want no part of this war, and the president's made it official we're not going to be a part of it, we couldn't help but be drawn. some to the Central Powers, but most to the Allies, and that's where we'll pick up when we return. So, number 9 and 10 upon our return.